The median price for a single-family home in San Francisco, according to Zillow, is not quite $1.4 million this morning. By comparison, the median price in Medford is about $1.1 million less. But then lots more people want to live in San Francisco than in Medford. Demand and supply and zoning and NIMBY and more drove up real estate prices there and elsewhere in California, with obviously a ripple effect on our region. Connor Doherty gives those details and more in his book, Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America. Connor Doherty is an economics reporter at the New York Times. He moved to the Times after a decade covering housing and the economy for the Wall Street Journal. Connor grew up in the Bay Area, and lives with his family in Oakland. Connor Doherty, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me. You live in a lovely part of the world that I love staying in.
So oh, good. Well, we're glad to get a chance to visit from time to time. And you probably notice the difference in real estate prices when you come up here.
I definitely do. I think that, though, there's a difference between places that are, I mean, this is kind of what the book is about in some ways, is that there are these big, complicated, or even mid-sized and complicated cities, Portland, the Bay Area, Minneapolis, Denver, Seattle, whatever, pick your place, and those are places where people go to work and work for large companies and stuff, and kind of move themselves along in the economy. And I think part of the book is looking at if some of that opportunity is being eroded by high home prices and high rent.
Well, as you point out, California, this is a good reminder, got very rich and very poor at the same time. Explain the dynamics there.
So just to back up for a moment, I wanted to kind of look at local government and the role that local government plays in really determining where, how, and at what cost we build shelter, you know, shelter, this, you know, human need. And so I use the Bay Area as a lens into things that are happening all around the country. But to answer your question, we have an economy around the country, really around the world, that has kind of bifurcated into what's called knowledge work, you know, people who either work with software or biomedical things, but, you know, in some fashion or form, they work with their minds and multiply it with a digital device of some kind. And then there's service sector, which is people who work in, you know, hotels or watch after children or walk dogs or clean homes or, you know, do other things that are really a linchpin of our economy. And what's unfortunate, or what's happened in our economy, is that this kind of knowledge work side has really run away with everything, while this kind of more service sector side is, you know, has stagnant wages and is really suffering from rising rents. What's important about that, those two groups, isn't just that they're on the, you know, kind of the have and have not scale of the economy, though that's obviously important. It's that they have to be next to each other. Knowledge workers, whatever you want to call them, software workers, they tend to want to cluster together because they share ideas. Their companies have these open layout offices. You know, there's all these premiums to people, and I'm sure you live this in your own life. You have news meetings with people, and I'm sure that those meetings are much more fruitful when they're face to face, and you're kind of talking about what you're going to do that day. Than they are when somebody's working from home or whatever. It's not to say that's not allowed, but, you know, it's usually better face-to-face. And then these service workers, they're usually performing some kind of face-to-face or, you know, personal operation, so they have to live nearby. So that's our economy. That's what happened over 30, 40 years. But our housing market looks nothing like that. And so we've created this situation where we have no space, no market for people who are not, you know, on that kind of knowledge work escalator. And in the Bay Area, which is really just a magnified version of something that's happening around the country, you're even seeing it applied to really good, solid, you know, middle to even upper middle income jobs like teachers and police officers and nurses. There's all the, you know, the whole kind of fabric of our local government and even our community is sort of being torn apart by having one group of people who have to live 2-3 hours away. So, like I said, the Bay Area is a much more exaggerated version of this, and it also makes for an entertaining tale because the political culture is a little
it's unique,
erratic, shall we say. But But like I said, I traveled extensively for this book, and went to Minneapolis, I went to Vancouver, to British Columbia, to try to get like a little bit of an international perspective. And I ended up leaving a lot of that stuff out of the book because I just found that it was the same everywhere. It just was a little bit of a dampened version of it.
You come back in the book, in part of the history lesson, to a Life magazine story in 1945, October, right after World War II ended, about the California way of life. I mean, is that way of life led to this point in history now?
Well, what I thought was fascinating about that article is that there has long been this frame that California is a look at the nation's future. And you could probably say the same thing about Oregon. I mean, you could probably say the same thing about the West, but California being so large kind of it makes for an easy magazine story. And this frame, I think, is true. You know, you see all these people come out to the West to live their lives in a way that they think is exceptional. Sometimes it's a religious belief. Sometimes it's they want to start a new kind of company. Sometimes it's they want to push, they want to create a new kind of more progressive government, whatever it is. We're all used to people coming out, I mean, even in to people coming out here and thinking that they have found a way to do things differently. And so for decades and decades and decades, people have used California as this look at the nation's future. And as that Life magazine shows, this vision was, by and large, a very positive vision. I mean, that magazine article has three families. In today's dollars, one makes $700,000, the other makes $150,000, and the other is a fireman. The last one is a fireman who makes, in today's dollars, about $40,000. The fireman and the guy, there's a pretty big difference between the fireman and the guy making $700,000. But the difference between the guy making $150,000, again, these are in inflation-adjusted dollars, and $40,000 is not that great. The fireman lives in a six-room house in Glendale with an orange tree in the backyard. It's a very positive vision. And so what that magazine article was trying to say is, and it was true, is this is this new era of prosperity we're entering. Mm-hmm. And so what I think what I was trying to do with my book is say, well, we now have a cautionary tale, and we need to really think hard about how we're going to get housing right. Because when we look at California, it's kind of a almost apocalyptic vision at this point.
Right, very different from that Life magazine article. The book is called Golden Gates. Connor Doherty is the author. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. So we talked in general terms right now. Let's meet somebody here. Sonia Trauss shows up at the San Francisco Planning Commission. Who is she, and why was her visit such a revelation?
Well, so thank you for going that way. This story, I should say, you know, this book is full of characters. And so the way I structured it narratively is it's all these interwoven tales. And these people show up, and sometimes someone's the villain, and sometimes they're the hero, and sometimes they're... And the whole point is to kind of show how housing complicated is, how complicated housing is, without making the book seem complicated, because in each chapter you're just following this character trying to get something they want. And it's pretty straightforward what they're after. So Sonia is a kind of a lifelong rabble-rouser. She's been organizing and doing kind of, she organized a parade troop at one point, tried to fight for health care for graduate students at her university. She was always getting involved in some kind of activism. She moved to the Bay Area to help a family member with chemotherapy and realized it was very expensive. So being a kind of activist, she started writing letters to the local planning commission saying, you need to build more housing. I think you have a housing shortage. And then she organized her friends into a group that she will be forever remembered for. She organized it into a group called the Bay Area Renters Federation, or BARF. And this got a lot of attention, not all of it positive, as one can imagine. But it really became this huge thing. She ended up attracting a lot of money from Silicon Valley people, all these kind of younger, millennial-aged renters who were struggling with the same problem really glommed onto her. And it's become this whole thing called the YIMBY, Yes in My Backyard movement. Shortly after I met Sonia, somebody invited me to a national conference of, quote, YIMBYs. It was called YIMBY Town, and it was in Boulder, Colorado. I remember thinking to myself at the time, this is going to be like three people in a bar. How can I go to this? But I actually got a different story in Boulder for that weekend just so that I could rationalize the cost of going there. So I went there and I did this whole other separate story just to, because I was so convinced it would be nobody. But it was like 200 people. There was the mayor of Sitka, Alaska was there. The mayor of Boulder was there. All these people, some two women flew in from Brisbane, Australia. All these people from around the country, you know, generally around the same age. There were some older people there. But they were all super concerned about the price of housing, and they were saying, we need to build more housing that, you know, they had set themselves up as in opposition to the quote-unquote NIMBYs, which is not in my backyard and is often personified by a single-family homeowner that wants to prevent anything from being built near them. Mm-hmm. And this movement over the next year, the 3 years I reported the book, just grew and grew and grew. They had a conference in Oakland. They had a conference in Boston last year. And just next month, in April, they're going to have their fourth annual conference in Portland. And it's they're grown to these quite large conferences. They're 300-400 people in some cases. They come from all over the country. I don't want to break any news, but they are attracting larger, very serious policymakers. Hmm. But when I caught this thing at the very beginning, and this is what I think that makes the book kind of, I was kind of lucky. I mean, I met Sonia when she was truly just this kind of crazy person showing up at the Board of Supervisors, and I was smart enough, I guess, to turn on my recorder and watch it unfold. But it was this guerrilla movement that has really, I don't want to say Sonia is like solely responsible for the whole thing, although she is largely responsible. It's become this big national thing, and it's almost like a national local movement. And what I find so fascinating about that is that local government is something we don't think about as much as we think about, say, like the presidency, but it's so essential to our lives.
Well, it is, and I say this a lot, because it's not the president who's going to decide if McDonald's gets to build next to your house. It's the local authorities.
Totally, and also, and this is what I hope, I don't know how much, the thing that's been really gratifying for me about the reception of the book is people keep telling me, and they keep saying it on Amazon, I didn't expect this book to be funny, because it's about housing policy and there's displacement, and there are some very sad stories in there, but local government is also just so bizarre and inspiring. But also, if you really go and hang out at a city council meeting, it is a wild place, and I tried to sort of bring some of that out in the book through things like BARF and, you know, a pretty small but determined group of people can have a really miraculous effect on their local government in not that much time. I mean, and the other thing I like about local government is the people who are in it seem so normal. I hate to sound like anti-elitist or whatever, because I guess it's great when people get great educations and all that, but I feel like the people we see run for president always seem like these mercenaries who've been, you know, wanted to be president since they're 5 years old and have calculated everything. I mean, I'm stereotyping a little bit, sure, but it does feel that way sometimes. Local government is really just concerned people who kind of accidentally get into these things. They are raising money for something, or a church, or a cause, or a school, or, and next thing you know, they kind of get into politics. And so inside the middle of this kind of story is this kind of wonderful tale, I think, of younger people, you know, people 25-ish, discovering that their democracy can be totally accessible to them if they just try. And I think within that is this kind of scary message, because you do sometimes show up to city council meetings and go, wow, like, people will listen to me almost to a degree that scares me. But also, you can really affect change in your community pretty quickly if you just get involved and try. But then there's other stories in this book, too. There's this girl, a 15-year-old girl named Stephanie, who I hung out with I got to know her family quite well over 3 months, and she comes home one day, and there's a note taped to her door that says, your rent is about to go up $800.
45%. That was in San Mateo County. Yes.
And her mom, Stephanie's mom, does elder care, cleans houses, and does janitorial work. So she's all those people in one day. and they don't have any ability to. $800 more dollars a month is more money than they like have. Period. It's not they can't afford it. Like that's literally more money than they have. And so Stephanie ends up organizing all these apartment complexes. She organizes her apartment complex through that, learns that other apartment complexes are going through the same thing. She organizes them. And one of the kind of things that makes this book, one of the kind of to highlight, I was telling you that I tried to interlock stories. So kind of spoiler, they do get displaced by this rent increase. It's a little more complicated than that, so read to find
details,
out.
Yeah.
But then I went and met the family who moved in and got to know their story, and they're not bad people or anything. They were actually in a very similar situation. And you learn after, the reader learns after Stephanie is displaced, that they've actually met this other family that moves in after them earlier in the story and have learned and have kind of empathized with their story. So, and I did that to kind of show, like, through this kind of weird invisible hand of the housing market, we're all kind of pushing each other around without knowing it. It's not like we're bad people. You know what I mean?
Right. It's just
but when you see this family come in, you go, oh, you start to feel very, I mean, I hope you feel this way, right? But you start to feel very conflicted, like, wait, I thought I was just feeling bad for this family, and now they're the family who moved in. They're the family who's going to pay this higher rent increase, you know, that has displaced this other family. And I just thought that by interweaving those stories, you could kind of capture both a very different segments of society. So kind of like not to sound too grandiose, but I tried to think about some of those old social novels where you would meet people from the richest to the poorest. And so there are some very rich people. And I mean, Jeremy Stoppelman, one of the characters, probably has $400-500 million. He's the founder of Yelp and has started funding Sonia and other people. But then you also meet, I mean, I spent some time in a homeless encampment too, but you also meet these kind of struggling tenants and you sort of see how their lives kind of interlock through policy, in this case through one apartment unit and displacement. And so, anyway, like I said, I thought that that would help us all understand how interconnected we are. I mean, it's funny.
The narratives really do help. And I want to remind our listeners, we're talking to Connor Doherty from the New York Times about his book, Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America. We have an email here from Joy and Talent, who writes, there's one tiny flaw with more housing equals affordability, and that is capitalism. Many years on a planning commission and this planet have shown that developers, builders, and landlords will always charge the maximum the market will allow. The direct line to affordable housing is subsidized housing. Also, affordability aside, what is the solution to homelessness? Oh, yeah, subsidized housing, writes Joy in Talent Planning Commissioner.
So I don't disagree with Joy at all, in the sense that we are going to have to really talk more seriously about hugely expanded affordable housing, subsidized housing in this country. We should probably revisit public housing. It does not have a great reputation in this country.
No, the projects and all, yeah.
But it works great in other countries, so we can. There's nothing that says it can't work here. We do have to be mindful of how we do it, not to repeat the same mistakes. But market rate housing is a big piece of our housing market. I don't think that's going away. And let's remember, for decades and decades and decades, subsidized. There were teachers and firefighters and police officers and radio station workers and journalists who all bought market rate housing. Maybe it wasn't in the absolute fanciest neighborhood, but this was something that large swaths of America were participating in. I mean, for decades, housing was the singular symbol, market rate housing, really, of American prosperity. Nixon famously went to Russia for some symposium when he was vice president to Dwight Eisenhower, and they had a model ranch house there, and Nixon said to Nikita Khrushchev, you know, any steel worker could buy this. And this was not bluster. At that time, this was the singular symbol that our way of life was working. And now housing is, of course, the singular symbol of our economy, of inequality, and this economy just, like, not working. I'll leave with this, with joy. Homelessness, there's no way to solve homelessness other than permanent supportive housing. I agree with her wholeheartedly on that. And even though I'm not terribly optimistic this is happening anytime soon, I do think we're going to need a much, much, much larger federal role in doing this. I don't think San Francisco or California or Ashland can produce the amounts of money it would take to build subsidized housing at the scale we need. Mm-hmm. But for now, I guess we have to kind of try because we're not getting a lot of help there.
Now, the interesting figure, more than interesting, that's really kind of the key to all this, you point out that the San Francisco area created 8 jobs for every new housing unit during the tech boom, and the good ratio is somewhere under 2 jobs for every new housing unit, so definitely not keeping up. You point out over the course of the book, Connor, that California did not become so much anti-growth as anti-sprawl, but if you don't build out, you have to build up, don't you? And that's been a lot of resistance there.
Thank you so much for bringing this up, because this is the piece that I always really try to emphasize to people. The Bay Area has added all sorts of jobs, and all sorts of jobs means they've added all sorts of office buildings. And there's this kind of famous, at least locally, but I think a lot of people around here have thought about it, or a lot of people around the country are at least aware of it. Apple has this new headquarters in Cupertino, and it looks like a spaceship. It looks like a giant donut. Nice. A number of people have seen it online, but it's this circular, massive donut. And this headquarters, if you were to stand it up, it's not terribly tall, but if you were to stand it up, that would be like a skyscraper.
Mm-hmm.
So they built what is the equivalent of a skyscraper for tens of thousands of workers in the middle of this relatively small town of Cupertino. And there is anybody can go YouTube this. There is a meeting where Steve Jobs himself, before his death, went to Cupertino and tried to get approval for this project. And they ask him all the right questions. They ask him, what about affordable housing? What about all these things? And he says, you know, you should work on that. That's your job, not my job. Whether or not anyone agrees with that. He says that that's what we pay taxes for. I mean, all these things. And then what happens? They approve this gigantic new office building. They have not approved any housing. And then they say that, you know, local control, then they say they're worried about traffic and it's unfair that local control, that the state wants to take some degree of local control from them to essentially force them to build housing. But here's what I say to that. You can go watch on that YouTube video them affirmatively through the same community processes that we idealize around housing, approving this massive, basically skyscraper, though, you know, it's in a circle, for all these jobs. So they are creating this problem. They are affirming that they want a lot more jobs than housing. And I do think that it is incumbent upon communities like that to say, it's incumbent upon someone to tell communities like that, if you're going to create all those jobs through this building of this office building, you're going to have to accept some degree of responsibility for housing and affordable housing as well. Just returning for a moment, like I said, to when we were talking about the economy and knowledge work and all that, they are creating all these knowledge jobs, but they're abdicating their responsibility to create any kind of housing for the service sector that everyone knows is going to grow up to kind of be close to those high-paid tech employees.
Well, that's a real mismatch in power, too, isn't it?
Yes,
you're talking about a $1 trillion capitalized company against this Planning Commission of Cupertino.
But I kind of reject that. The Planning Commission could say, you know, sure, we're going to let you build that thing, but here's this fee or that fee, and then we're going to build affordable housing somewhere else. I don't think, and Apple, by the way, just committed multiple billions of dollars to affordable housing. Here's the thing, no matter what kind of housing it is, you have to build it. You know, a mile from Apple's headquarters, there is a dead mall, this sun-faded carcass of this brown mall that nobody goes to anymore, and it's like half demolished at this point. And a developer wants to build a new project over there that will have some amount of retail and other stuff, but we'll have, I think, 30 or 40% affordable housing. And they actually reformed the project specifically to add a bunch more affordable housing, because that would, for very complicated reasons, make it almost impossible for them to... It would make it very easy for them to get it approved. The local people there are suing them to stop this basically affordable housing development near Apple's headquarters. Hmm. So I don't care how much money you raise for this. We need more. I agree. You still have to build it. You know, it's an image. This is not a...
We're down to our last few seconds, so...
Sorry. I will leave you with this. Well, we only have a few seconds left. Please pick up the book. That is what I will say. It is a fun story. It is a tale of different people, and you learn a lot in the book, but you really just feel a lot.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I'm most proud of, is that you know what it's like to be a 15-year-old girl and have your life destroyed by an eviction. You know what it's like to be a millennial renter. You know what it's like to be a city manager caught between all these warring factions just trying to find some common purpose.
Yeah, great stories to go in there with the facts and figures. So Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America. Connor Doherty, thank you so much.